This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last week, we talked about private prisons in Georgia, but there are also private probation companies in the state. County courts contract with them to collect fines from offenders. But those companies also add fees in order to make a profit themselves. People who violate probation by not paying are sometimes jailed, even though the Supreme Court outlawed debtors' prisons 35 years ago. In the last couple of years, Georgia law changes made it harder for private probation companies to operate. So what happens now to people who don't pay their fines? Beth Schwartzapfel is a reporter with the Marshall Project. She joins me from New York. Beth, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Atlanta attorney Akiva Friedland of the Southern Center for Human Rights. Hi, Akiva.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Akiva, can you run down the changes in the law that occurred in 2015 that have changed business, I guess, for these private probation companies?
So there were quite a few changes in the law, and I'd say the three main things are, first, restating what the Supreme Court has already said, which is that a person should not be jailed for inability to pay, something that had already been decided but has often been ignored. The second is limiting the amount of fees that a company can extract from a person simply because they were unable to pay a fine on day one, which is kind of the heart of the way that the system punishes poor people. And it also beefed up the state's regulatory agency that kind of looks into the company's operations.
I want to play for you, Beth and Akiva, two little comments. The first one that we'll start with is from an interview in 2014, Robert Ingvaldson. He was the district court judge in Benton County, Washington, and he's here defending that county used a lot of fines and fees and jail times for people who didn't pay those fees. Here he is.
You commit a crime, there are consequences. And we only have two consequences. That's your time or it's your money. If they won't pay the money, the only thing that we can take from them at that point is their time.
And here is the second one. This is from Ionia, Michigan, District Court Judge Raymond Vogt. He also spoke with NPR in 2014. And he himself, that judge, has locked people up who couldn't pay their fines.
If I got someone standing in front of me for something that's labeled a misdemeanor, and they've failed to follow through with court orders on that, am I supposed to tell the rest of the world, the rest of the law-abiding citizens, that they're chumps and fools for having respected the law and respected the court's orders? I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to make fools or chumps out of people who follow the law and comply with court orders.
So, Beth, to what extent do we have any other mechanisms for, I guess, punishment or redress if it's not either jail or fees?
Well, the term punishment implies that somebody's willfully done something wrong. And I think where we should begin is with the issue that these are folks who have done things that all of us have done. They've ran a red light. Maybe they were speeding. Maybe they made an illegal left turn. And so we all begin in the same place, which is that they owe some kind of fine or fee. So say the fee is $250 or I'm pulling that number out of thin air. But it's some, you know, annoying amount of money that for somebody in a certain financial situation is just that, annoying. For somebody who is living in poverty, that is literally impossible. And so first off, you're stratifying two people who have done exactly the same thing into two different groups. And you're saying, if you have the $250 up front, you pay your fine, you grumble about it, and you're on your way. Those who don't have it now are put in certain states are now put on misdemeanor probation, and suddenly the fines can double or triple as you owe money not just to the court, and then you may owe a late payment fee to the court, and now you start owing money to your private probation company, which is essentially functioning as a debt collector, and so I think the law that allows courts to lock you up for not paying is sort of explicitly assumes that you are willfully choosing not to pay. If you cannot pay, if you lack the means to pay despite a goodwill desire to pay, then that's when certain counties start talking about certain payment plans or community service to allow you to pay down your debts to the community. There are other ways to have people be accountable for whatever mistake they made in the first place.
And Beth just brought up the $250 ticket. In fact, most tickets in Georgia particularly are much more expensive than that. Let's hear from Shara Shannon of the University of Georgia. She's talking about the fact that she actually studied fees and fines in a dozen states. She found Georgia stands out for the use of probation in order to collect criminal justice debt.
if you commit certain types of offenses related to driving, so reckless driving or DUI, this 10% surcharge gets added on to your base fine, and that goes to a beneficiary that's separate from the state. It's a trust fund that people with any kind of brain or spinal injury can apply for.
But, and yet, oftentimes these fees are added on because they say they want to pay the court, but it sounds like Sarah Shannon isn't actually convinced that's what's happening.
It's not funding the courts. It's not funding a state function. And so it really gets into the question of what is the purpose behind these surcharges? Is it to fund the system, or is it really to fund other things that should be funded elsewhere, like through tax dollars?
So, Akiva, do we know where all of this money is going? Is there a good oversight?
So is there oversight, or where is the money going might be two separate questions. But if you're asking about, you know, let's say where does someone someone leaves court with a given financial obligation, where does it go? So I had a client who was an elderly disabled woman who lived on $700 a month in disability and nothing else. And as a result of mental condition, she stole about $20 worth of underwear and some food from Walmart. She went to court, and where she was not given access to an attorney and was convicted of shoplifting. And she left court that day with a $1,600 fee and fines and fees. If you added up her entire bill, that would be about $1,600.
Holy cow.
So it was something like a $925 fine, most of which goes to the city that was running the court. You have several hundred dollars that is going to the state in the state surcharges that Professor Shannon has been writing about. And then you have, I think in her case, maybe $400 that would be going to the probation company for a quote-unquote supervision, which in most cases, especially in the pay-only cases like traffic offenses, really just means collecting money and harassing people who can't pay, as well as a $95 fee for a class that the probation company itself offers. That's an anti-theft class. I think if you look at her case, it's a good example of why, even if you are funding the court and its operations, it doesn't really make sense to fund those functions through a regressive tax on disabled people who already need public assistance to survive.
We have about 20 seconds. Beth, is this, some of this going to change because of changes in the law?
Well, I had a number of people who study this issue caution that, you know, I think that making it harder for companies to make a living will drive some of them out of the business. And we saw that with Sentinel Offender Services, which was the largest private probation company exiting the private probation business.
Just this year in January. And that's Beth.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's Beth Schwartzapfel. She's a reporter with the Marshall Project, and attorney Akiva Friedland is with the Southern Center for Human Rights. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.